This message, titled The Mocking Friend, from Job chapter 20, verse 1 through Job 21, verse 34, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com.
Well, brothers and sisters, I was reminded this week of something that C.S. Lewis once wrote. He once wrote these words, simple, but wise and profound. I have often repented of speech, but hardly ever of silence. And I think this morning it's fair to say that if Job's friends had any degree of spiritual sensitivity, then they would realize that they had much to repent of. They had come to Job, they had sat for a week with him in silence, and then each of them, in cyclical turns, take time to speak to Job, each of them speaking wrongly, each of them speaking falsely, each of them speaking extremely unhelpful words. And they begin to sound like a broken record. Every time they speak, they continue to sin in the things that they speak to their friend. Well, this morning we come to the third friend of Job's, a man by the name of Zophar the Naamathite. You remember this now is the second time that Zophar has spoken to Job. And unlike the other two friends, Eliphaz and Bildad, this will actually be the last time in the book of Job that Zophar speaks. And when Zophar first opened his mouth to speak to his friend, to try to interpret his suffering, to try to prescribe some kind of remedy to Job, perhaps you remember that the particular sin of Zophar is that he was a master at twisting the truth. He brought certain truths to bear, but then he twisted them slightly so that they would fit into Job's situation. And we saw when we looked at that first speech of Zophar how wrong and how sinful he was in doing that. Well, after each friend had taken a turn speaking, we know that they have each begun to speak again. And each of those friends can be characterized in a little bit different of a way. We've seen how Eliphaz, the first friend, really becomes the accusing friend. He comes at Job with all kinds of false accusations. We saw last week that Bildad came and he really became the usurping friend. Job says to Bildad, "Why do you pursue me the way that God does?" Saying, "Bildad, you have put yourself in the place of God in my life." And Bildad usurped the rights that only God has as he spoke to his friend. Well, this morning, if we were to characterize Zophar's second speech to Job, we might do it under the simple word and the singular word, mocking. This so-called friend of Job, who looks and sounds more like a foe, is a mocking friend. And in fact, we get that from the very words of Job himself. When Job responds to Zophar's second speech, Job says, "Bear with me while I speak, and after I have spoken, mock on." "Let me speak," Job is saying, "for a moment. And if you will suffer me to do that, then you can continue to mock me the way that you have been." Zophar shows himself to be a mocking friend. I want to point out this morning that in the things that Zophar says, there's very little that is new to us. All of Job's friends come and they all come with the same arguments. They all come with the same reasoning. They all come with the same logic. There's nothing new. They continue to beat the dead horse, as the proverbial saying goes. And all that Zophar is saying in chapter 20 amounts to this: Job, the wicked suffer. It is only the unrighteous who suffer. And you are suffering. Therefore, Job, you are unrighteous. You are suffering, therefore you are wicked, because only the unrighteous suffer. And Zophar describes that in such graphic detail. And he goes into such nuanced details to speak of how the wicked suffer, that calamity comes upon them almost instantaneously. If we were to go through the words that he speaks, once again, you would see that he compares how quickly calamity and suffering come upon the wicked. He compares it to the way we eat food. Oh, it tastes good in the mouth, but by the time it reaches the stomach, it makes him sick and it kills him. And Zophar saying that's true of the wicked. They suffer and they suffer quickly. God does not spare them for a season or for a time, but he brings ruin and doom upon them. And Zophar's point is this: Job, your ruin and your doom is upon you because you are an unrighteous and you are a wicked man. And imagine the pain of hearing that. Imagine how that adds to the physical and mental, spiritual suffering of Job. To have friends come not once, not twice, not three times, not four times, not five times, but now six times to say, Job, the only reason you're suffering is because you are an unrighteous man. But Job repels the things that Zophar says, as he has done in the past. He points out the obvious. He points out the obvious that the wicked and the unrighteous often in this life prosper. They often go to the grave and their lives are marked by trouble-free carelessness. Well, this morning, as we develop this a little more, as we look a little more in details, I want to focus on two particular parts. And the first part of the message this morning will be the mocker's contempt. The mocker's contempt. And the second part this morning will be the mocker's compromise. The mocker's compromise. So while Zophar is saying the same things that Job's other friends have said, and while Job is saying the same things that he has said again and again, I want us to see in a little new detail, and from a maybe a little new of an angle, the mocker's contempt and the mocker's compromise. And so first this morning, I want us to see something of the mocker's contempt. That's really born, as I've said, out of the language of Job. In chapter 21, verse 3, as Job is responding to Zophar, again, he says, you know what, Zophar, be quiet for a moment. Let me speak my words. And then, you know what you can do, Zophar? You can mock on. You can go on mocking me. And quite literally, that word that Job is using there as he says that is, it means you can go ahead and hold me in derision. You can despise me. You can hold me in contempt. That's what it means to mock somebody, to hold them in contempt, to deride them, to despise them, to hold them in derision. And you know, that's really, and we need to remember this as we go through the book of Job, that really is a heartbreaking turnaround. In Job chapter 2, when we are introduced to these friends, in many ways they seem like ideal friends. They seem like the best of friends. Many of us could only imagine having friends like these friends that we are first introduced to. They hear of Job's suffering and their hearts are moved and they're sympathetic and they're empathetic. And they gather themselves together and they say, you know what, let's not wait for Job to come to us. We're going to go to him. Our friend is suffering. Our friend is grieving. Our friend's life has been shattered around him. Let's go and help him pick up the pieces. And these friends travel from long distances and they gather with Job. And we read, I want you to remember this, when we go through Job, what was their reaction? They saw Job from a distance. And they couldn't even make out their friend. He was so covered with boils and wounds. And they tore their clothes. They sprinkled dust on their heads and they sat with him in silence. It really is, in that opening chapter, really a picture of the kind of friends all of us would want in the midst of our suffering. But what a heartbreaking turnaround. As these friends bear with Job in the long term, we find that there's little to no sympathy in their hearts. We find that there is little to no empathy in their hearts. And we find now that this third friend who once prostrated himself in the dust with Job is mocking this suffering man. And he does it so callously. He does it so cruelly. One commentator really captured a picture of the kind of person that Zophar is when he wrote these words. Zophar, as he comes to us in chapter 20, Zophar is the kind of person that we would happily live if we never saw him again. That's what this man has turned into. He's the kind of person we would be happy if we never had to see him again. You perhaps know people like that. You have perhaps met people like that. You think, well, I met them once and that's good enough. If I never see that person, I never have to have another conversation with that person again. That I'm okay with that. Not out of spite, not out of hatred. It's just this recognition that's not the kind of person I want to be around. And that's the kind of person Zophar is. The care that he had for his friend has melted away into utter cruelty and utter contempt. And I want you to see something of that this morning. How is it that this mocking friend, how does he hold Job in contempt? Well, he has contempt for Job. First, we can see in these words, in his stubbornness. In his stubbornness. I want to remind you again, I've already said it this morning, but this is not the first, this is not the second, this is not the third, this is not the fourth, this is not the fifth time that Job's friends have now come to him and said, Job, you're suffering because you're on. This is the sixth time. The sixth time that one of Job's friends have come to him with this argument, you're suffering because you're wicked. And Job has responded, and Job has given them reasons why that cannot be the case. He has given them reasons from the character of God, from the nature of God. He has given them reasons from the hope that he has in his Redeemer and in his heavenly witness. He has given them reasons and evidences from the life that he lives. And yet not once, not twice, not three, six times they come stubbornly with this same charge. Job, only the wicked suffer. You're suffering, therefore you are wicked. It is the point of all that Job's friends say again and again and again. And it demonstrates for us, it demonstrates for you, and it demonstrates for me, brothers and sisters, a tremendous stubbornness. This man is holding Job in contempt by his stubbornness. And I want to be careful this morning that we understand what that means. I want to be careful this morning that we understand what that is not, if I can put it that way. As Christians, brothers and sisters, as men and women who believe the Bible and believe the things that God has said, there is, in all Christians, to be what we might call a certain uncompromising conviction. We are to have uncompromising convictions regarding the things that God has said. And to some people, that may seem like stubbornness. But there is a place for this in the Christian life. You need only to think of the Apostle Paul, perhaps, this morning. The Apostle Paul was a man with a lot of convictions. And a lot of convictions that a lot of people today would probably say, well, Paul, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. The Apostle Paul didn't only have convictions about what we might call the basics or the essentials of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But if you read the Apostle Paul and you read his letters and the way in which he instructs the churches, Paul's got convictions on all kinds of things. Paul's got convictions on how we ought to worship. Paul's got convictions on what baptism is. Paul's got convictions on what the Lord's Supper is. Paul's got convictions on what prayer should be and how we ought to make prayer and who it is that ought to pray. Paul's got convictions about the civil government and why we ought to pay our taxes. Paul's got convictions on the clothes that we ought to wear. Paul's got convictions on how husbands and wives should relate to one another. Paul's got convictions about how we ought to conduct ourselves in the workplace. Paul has convictions about the words that we speak and what we do with our time. And you see, there's something Christian in that. And Paul, as an apostle of Jesus Christ, writing under the inspiration of the Spirit, we are reminded that as Christians, we are to be people who have uncompromising convictions. But even as we have uncompromising convictions, the Bible is equally clear that we are to hold them in love. That we are to be the humble, that we are to be the most humble of all people. That despite being men and women and children who have convictions, that doesn't mean we're not teachable. The Apostle Paul says that the elders in the church, those who probably should be the most knowledgeable, that a preeminent mark of an elder is still to be teachable. We are to have uncompromising convictions. But what I want you to see in Zophar and in Job's friends is that is not the kind of stubbornness they show. It's not this uncompromising conviction that is informed by the scriptures. It is rather what we might simply call a bullheadedness. Or as the scriptures speak of it, a stiff neck. One who refuses, despite well-reasoned logic, despite evidence to the contrary, as Job has been giving his friends, those who just double down and buckle down under their own opinions and their own preferences and their own understanding and their own knowledge. That's what Zophar is. And that is, in one sense, how he is holding Job in contempt. He is stubborn. Job has given reason upon reason why it is that the wicked are not the only ones who suffer. And it's like Zophar is plugging his ears, doubling down, digging his heels in, and simply refusing to listen, refusing to learn, refusing to change, refusing to be teachable in any way. He is, if I can put it this way, enclosed in an armor of obstinacy. And we're warned against, as Christians, we're warned of the dangers of that. Wisdom teaches us in Proverbs 29:1 that those who are stiff-necked, those who are stubborn, will soon be broken. The psalmist teaches us to sing in Psalm 32, verse 9, "Don't be like the horse, don't be like the mule that needs a bit and a bridle in its jaw to be turned whichever way because they're so stubborn in their own ways and so set in their own ways." Proverbs 18:2 tells us, "A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his own opinions." You see, that's what Zophar's become. He's become the fool. He's become stiff-necked. He's become stubborn. And in so doing, he mocks Job. It's not only through stubbornness, but Zophar holds Job in contempt through his impatience. Look at how this begins in chapter 20. "Then Zophar the Naamathite answered and said, 'Therefore my thoughts answer me because of my haste within me. I hear censure that insults me, and out of the understanding a spirit answers me.'" Go back for a moment. What is it that Job has just said? Well, chapter 19 ends with that tremendous profession of faith. Job saying, I know that my Redeemer lives. And he's using that to protect himself against the accusations of his friends. And then he comes and he says in verse 28 of the 19th chapter, if you say how we will pursue him and the root of the matter is found in him, be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. And as Job says that, the picture that Zophar paints even of himself is he can't wait another moment. He's not going to think about Job's words. He's not going to meditate on Job's words. He's not going to tremble at Job's words. He just needs to get in the fight. And that's exactly what Zophar says. My thoughts answer me because of my haste within me. I remember growing up, all of you know that I have a twin brother. And one of the things my brother and I loved doing when we were growing up, and if you ask our wives, maybe still today, we loved to argue. We loved to argue everything. And I remember one of the lessons that my parents had to continually teach us until the very day we moved out of the house is, you guys need to learn to listen. Because what you do, Kyle, when Michael is speaking, you don't sit there and listen to understand, but you just jump at the bit to get your word in edgewise. And Michael, you do the exact same thing to Kyle. You just can't wait. You're not going to listen. You're just going to wait for the moment when you can strike. And that really is the picture of Zophar. Here is one who is jumping at the bit. Oh, Job has said something and I've got to jump on it right away. I've got to tell him why he's wrong. I've got to get my foot in the door. I've got to score my theological point, so to speak. And he reveals in those very words how impatient he is with his suffering friend. And Job even points that out in his response to Zophar. Keep listening to my words. And let this be your comfort. Or perhaps as it's better translated, keep listening to my words because it would be your comfort. Job is saying, Zophar, if you just slowed down for a moment and actually listened to the things that I have to say, you would not be as riled up and jumping at the bit to argue with me as you are. And you see what it does? It betrays a lack of patience. And brothers and sisters, I don't want to point the finger at Zophar this morning. I want to say that in Zophar, most of us can probably see a reflection of ourselves. Most of us can see the reality of what is true of our hearts, because patience, if we are honest, is probably one of the most excellent graces that you and I are most deficient in. Just this week, providentially, I read an autobiographical note from John Calvin. John Calvin, that man of tremendous learning, but a man who was also very sensitive to his own sins. And Calvin said, of all the vices that I struggle with, and I struggle with all kinds of sins, he said, I struggle with no other vice the way that I struggle with impatience in my heart. And Zophar demonstrates the impatience towards his suffering friend. And brothers and sisters, we need to learn from that. We need to be reminded. Patience is one of the crowning virtues of a Christian. Galatians chapter 5, it is one of the fruits of the Spirit. That if we are united to the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the true vine, and in him we are to bear much fruit, one of the fruits that every Christian man and every Christian woman and every Christian child ought to be bearing is the fruit of patience. And Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 13 that the first and foremost characteristic of Christian love is that it is patient. And that doesn't mean it comes easy. The biblical word for patience is long-suffering, because patience presupposes suffering. But brothers and sisters, it ought to be our glory to be men and women of patience. Because God has dealt and does deal so patiently with us. And because patience is such a benefit to others. But here Zophar sounds off, holding his friend in contempt by his impatience. Not only stubbornness, not only impatience, but Zophar's contempt for Job is expressed in his lack of charity. in his lack of charity. Zophar is stubborn. He's not going to change his mind. Zophar is impatient. He's not going to wait his turn or listen to understand. He's only going to listen to react. And that spills out in the words that he speaks in a great lack of what we might simply call Christian love. He's not at all concerned about Job. He's not at all concerned about Job's suffering. He's not at all concerned about Job's confusion and perplexity. He's not at all concerned about Job's physical wounds as he has scraped himself bloody with the shards of clay. He's not at all concerned that here is a man who, and we can't forget this as we go through the book of Job, has not only lost all of his wealth and all of his servants, but all of his children have died. And Zophar shows himself to be tremendous. Unloving. He has no regard for the reality of Job's suffering. He only wants to get his words in edgewise, and when he gets his words in edgewise, they cut like a sword. You're suffering, Job, because you're unrighteous. All your children died, Job, because you're a wicked man. You've lost all your servants, Job, because you're a sinner. Job, the reason you're bloodied and bruised is because you got what you deserved. And there is in those words and in that argument of Zophar, and I hope you see it plainly this morning, such a lack of love. It is so contrary to the spirit of charity. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 reminds us that it is not love's part to assume the worst. What I mean by that, it's not loving to assume the worst of people. It is not loving to jump to conclusions and to shoot from the hip. Paul tells us what in 1 Corinthians 13, love bears all things, love believes all things, love hopes all things, love endures all things. And Zophar's doing none of that. He jumps to the worst conclusions. He makes snap judgments as to why it is that Job is suffering, and it is, in his words, there is such a profound lack of love. You remember what Paul says in the beginning of 1 Corinthians 13. What are we if we lack love? Paul says, you are nothing but a clanging cymbal. Paul's imagery there is so graphic because what is a clanging cymbal? It's a rather pointless instrument. On its own, a cymbal can give no intelligible tune. It's useless. It's pointless. It's without much value. And Paul says that's exactly who and what you are if you lack love. And that's what we find of Zophar. And Job himself calls it out, doesn't he? In the 34th verse of chapter 21, as Job comes and he finishes his speech, he says, how then will you comfort me with empty nothings? There is nothing left of your answers but falsehoods. Job is saying, essentially, brothers and sisters, Zophar, you have failed to love me the way that you should. You have mocked me. You have held me in contempt. You see, that's the picture of Zophar. That's the contempt with which he approaches Job. Is it any wonder that commentator said how many of us would live a happy life if we never had to see someone like Zophar again? It's the mocker's contempt. But I don't want you to think this morning that for all these words that Zophar speaks, that the only danger is that of what we might call interpersonal relationships. There is something more going on here that you and I need to see. There's something more here that you and I need to understand. That even as Zophar mocks his friend, even as Zophar deals stubbornly with Job, even as Zophar deals impatiently with Job, even as Zophar deals uncharitably with Job, this doesn't just simply affect what we might call the interpersonal relationship between friends. Rather, there's a lot at stake here. There's a lot at stake. And so I want us, secondly, this morning to see something of what I am calling the mocker's compromise. What is it that is being compromised in the words that Zophar speaks? What is the cost of what he is saying? There is a toll, we might say, on the interpersonal relationship, but brothers and sisters, there is so much more. And if we're going to understand the book of Job, if we are going to understand the mind of the Spirit, then we need to see what it is that Zophar is compromising, or rather, what is at stake in the things that Zophar says. And what is it? Well, let me break it down this morning. First, in the words that Zophar is speaking, he is actually compromising, we might say. He is compromising God himself. Or to put it this way, he is compromising a right knowledge of God. Zophar, just like Bildad and just like Eliphaz before him, makes Job's suffering something that seems so simple, doesn't he? It's exactly what they're doing. Job, your suffering is simple. Here's the simple logic of the world. Here's the simple formula of the world in which we live. The wicked suffer, the unrighteous suffer, the righteous don't. Therefore, Job, you are unrighteous. And they repeat it again and again and again. And they're saying, Job, this is so easy. This is so simple. But you see, what we find, brothers and sisters, is that it is not that easy. And it is not that simple. And even Job points it out. The whole of chapter 21 is taken up with him pointing out the obvious, that he's saying, Zophar, it's not that simple. It's not that easy. In verse 7 of chapter 21, why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? You see what he says? Zophar is saying, Job, calamity comes upon the wicked really quick. And Job's saying, it's not true. The wicked live to old age. The wicked grow old. The wicked just don't die in their youth and in the strength of their bodies and spirits, but they grow old with age. And they grow mighty in power. Job is saying, Zophar, it's not that simple. It is not that obvious. He says in verse 13, the wicked spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. You've seen that. I've seen that. Some of the most wicked people in this world have lived the most prosperous, peaceful lives. And at the end of it all, they go to the grave, and they have lived a life of ease. Job is saying, Zophar, it is not that easy. And you see what Zophar's problem is. What Zophar's problem is in all of this is that he has too small a view of God. We need to remember that. That's the sin that backs all of his comments. He has too small a view of God. He thinks God and the way in which God works in this world and the ways of God, well, those things, Job, just fit into nice, neat categories. And the categories they fit into are the unrighteous suffer and the righteous prosper. And behind that thinking really is a very puny knowledge of who God is. It is a small understanding of him. And we need to sense the significance of that. Because Jesus himself in John 17 verse 3 tells us that eternal life is to know God. To grow in our understanding of what he has revealed concerning himself. And Zophar's problem is that in his simplicity, he's compromising God. And I think that's why, and we're going to get there in a few weeks, maybe a couple months here, but that's why when God finally opens his mouth and God finally speaks, God confronts Job, and he confronts Job's friends with what? With his magnificence, with his immensity, with his eternity. He is the God who says, I'm the one who laid the foundations of the world. Were you there when I did that? He says, I am the one who says to the waves, this far and no further, and I mark the boundaries between water and dry land. He says, I am the one who holds the snowstorms in the palm of my hand. They do my bidding. God comes to Job and to his friends, and he says, I am the one who ordains the day. I am the one who commands the morning. The sun rises by my word and by my power. And God says, it is me who sees the goat in the cleft of the mountain as it is giving birth. And God says, it is me who gives to the lions their prey that they might eat and rip the flesh off of their... God says, that's me. And we are confronted with this immense picture of who God is. And it's exactly what Zophar compromises. It's exactly what he misses. He thinks God fits into his nice, neat categories. And brothers and sisters, one of the things we must walk away with from the book of Job is the greatness of the God we worship. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. He is wholly other. He is beyond us, even as he has come to us in the Lord Jesus Christ. You see, that's what's at stake. That's what Zophar is compromising. But Zophar is also compromising assurance. He's compromising what we might call the doctrine of assurance. What do I mean by that? Well, very simply, every Christian has asked at some point in their life, and likely at many points in their life, how do I know that I'm a Christian? And that question has to do with what we call assurance. We all want to be assured. We all want to have an inward persuasion that I am loved by God. We all want to be inwardly persuaded that I am saved, that I am a child of God, that my destiny is to share eternal life with Jesus Christ. That's what assurance is. And you see, if you use Zophar's logic, if you actually hear what Zophar and what Bildad and what Eliphaz are saying to Job, you begin to see that what they're doing is compromising this thing we call the doctrine of assurance. Because what Zophar is saying in these words and what his friends before him are saying to Job, Job asks that question, is God my enemy? Is God against me? And his friends are saying, yes, Job. He is. His friends are saying, Job, you are unrighteous. That's why you're suffering. God is not your friend. You are not a child of God. You are not claimed by his grace. That's the logic of what they are saying. And I want you this morning to hear how ridiculous that is. They are saying, Job, because you are suffering, you can't be a child of God. What a ridiculous thing to say. Imagine this morning that somebody in this church or somebody came to me and they said, Pastor, how can I know that I'm a Christian? How do I know that I'm loved by God? And I said, well, I'll tell you what. You go home, grab your bank statement. You come back to me. Let me see the number on your bank statement. I'll tell you if you're a child of God. And they come to me and they hand me their piece of paper. And I say, oh, you've only got $15,000? No, you're not. You're not a child of God. A child of God has a lot of money. Or imagine somebody comes and they hand me their bank statement, it has $750,000, and I say, oh, you are a child of God. Because look at your bank account. I know it's ludicrous, but that's in a sense exactly what Job's friends are saying to him. Or imagine somebody comes and says, Pastor, how do I know that I'm a Christian? I say, well, let me see your left hand. Oh, there's a wedding ring on it? Yeah, you're a Christian because Christians get married. Oh, but there is no wedding ring. Well, you're not a Christian because Christians are those who ought to be and are married. But I know that these are ridiculous, exaggerated illustrations, but it proves the point. That's what Job's friends are saying. Job, you've got no health. Your health has been taken away. Therefore, you're not a Christian. Job, you have no wealth anymore. Your wealth has disappeared. You're not a son of God. Job, you don't have any more children. Your children have all gone to the grave. Therefore, God doesn't love you. He's your enemy. That's what they're telling their poor, suffering friend. And in saying that, they are destroying the doctrine of Christian assurance. As though we can only be assured that we are children of God when we are wealthy and healthy and when everything's going well and we have all kinds of prosperity. But that's what they're telling Job. And what should they have told Job? They should have been saying to their friend the exact things that Job says to them. Job, you have a redeemer. And you know that your redeemer lives. So whatever you are suffering in this life, your Redeemer lives, and with your two eyes you shall see him. What should they have said to Job? They should have told Job what Job said to them. Job, you have a heavenly witness. You have one who pleads your case with God himself. What should they have told Job? They should have said, Job, don't you see the evidences of the fruits of the Spirit in your life? Don't you see love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and self-control? Don't you see those things evident in your life, Job? You are a child of God, so that whatever suffering you are enduring. But that's not what they're saying. They're telling Job, base your assurance on your condition in this life. Base your assurance on your health and on your wealth and on your prosperity. And I want you to see this morning, that's what's at stake. That is what Zophar is compromising in these words that he speaks to Job. And so Job says, go on mocking me. But what else does Zophar compromise? Brothers and sisters, Zophar's words compromise the gospel. Oh, you might say, that's a hefty charge. It's a serious thing to compromise the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I know that this morning, and I don't mean that lightly, but I want you to see that is exactly what is at stake in the words that Zophar is speaking to Job, in the words Bildad is speaking to Job, in the words that Eliphaz is speaking to Job. Nothing less than the gospel is at stake. Why is that? Why do I say that this morning? Well, brothers and sisters, what does the gospel say? The gospel says the eternal Son of God became flesh. The gospel says that this one who became flesh, Jesus Christ, was born under the law. The gospel tells us that this one who was born under the law was made like us in every way, but was without sin. The gospel tells us that this one who was born under the law and without sin never once erred in his thoughts, never once transgressed in his words, never once committed iniquity with his hands, that he was holy, that he was righteous, that he was blameless, that he was undefiled, that no corruption could be seen in him, no corruption was in his heart, but he came as the one whom the Apostle John calls Jesus Christ, the righteous. But what else does the gospel tell us? The gospel tells us that this one who is righteous, this lamb who was without spot or without blemish, was slaughtered. That the sinless died for the sinful. That the righteous one died for the unrighteous. That the holy died for the unholy. The Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God in him. What does the gospel say? Brothers and sisters, the central point of the gospel is this. Jesus is a righteous sufferer. Jesus suffered not as one who was wicked. Jesus suffered not as one who was unrighteous. Jesus suffered not as one who in himself was sinful. But he suffered as one who was like a lamb without blemish or without spot. Jesus suffered worse than any man, though he was the best of all. And you see, if you trace out what Zophar is saying, there is no room in his thinking for that kind of gospel. There is no room in Zophar's thinking for one who is righteous to suffer in unfathomable ways. Zophar says only the unrighteous suffer. And that logic, carried out to its logical conclusion, compromises the gospel of Jesus Christ. I have wrestled, as we've been going through Job, I have wrestled privately and sometimes publicly with the repetitive nature of this book. Again and again and again and again and again and again, and we're going to find again and again, Job's friends try to make the same point. And the question is, why are we so wearied by this same point? Why is it that the Holy Spirit holds this same point forth time and again in the book of Job? It is for this reason, brothers and sisters. God is teaching us, the Spirit is teaching us through the utter failure of Job's friend. He is preparing us to understand the gospel. He is preparing us to understand that it is not only the unrighteous who suffer, but the righteous suffer. Even the righteous suffer. And we are not to end in looking at Job, but we are to end in seeing that this is the central point. This is the epicenter of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The righteous suffering for the unrighteous. The godly suffering for the godless. The holy one suffering for those who are lost in their grave of sin and of transgressions. And that's why the centerpiece of Job is intended again and again, week by week, to remind us of is the glory of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But you see what Zophar does and what Bildad does and what Eliphaz does. They compromise the gospel. That's what's at stake. That's what's at stake as Zophar mocks Job. Brothers and sisters, I have done the best I can to give us an understanding of this third friend. We see the way in which he holds Job in utter contempt. We see the way in which this friend compromises the knowledge of God. He compromises on assurance, and he compromises the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ. But brothers and sisters, it's not the end of the story. And we will see in weeks to come, if the Spirit is willing, how God will triumph over this, the mocker's contempt and the mocker's compromise. Let's pray.